I'm going to introduce Dr. Justin Varney, who is a specialist registrar in public health. And Justin is going to talk to us about the issues for the health issues and public health issues of not providing effective services to lesbian, gay, and bisexuals and trans communities. He's a member of the executive of the Gay and Lesbian Association of Doctors and Dentists, and is taking a leading role as part of that in external liaison, and he's also part of the Sexual Orientation Specialist Interest Group of NIME, which is the National Institute of, for Mental Health, and which now forms part of the National Steering Group on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity for the Department of Health.
Thank you. Am I on? Can you hear me? Fantastic. Well, first of all, I start by saying a huge thank you to Paul and Paul, really, because one of the great pleasures I've had over the last couple of months is coming up to Manchester once a month to help plan the National LGBT Health Summit. So date for your diary is the 20th and 21st of August, and it will be held here, hosted by the City Council with LGF, in August in Manchester, and so really put it in your diaries now. What I was going to talk about was why the public sector should care about LGBT health. Why is it important? And when I talk about the public sector, it's not just health. The public sector includes the police, the fire service, the local authority. But they also have this key relationship with strategic partners. And we use, those of us within the public sector are very good at jargon. So if I slip into it, somebody wave and slap me. Some time working with the departments made it a very bad habit. But strategic partnerships are working with the academic units, Manchester University here, and some of the other academic bases. It's working with private business and industry. It's working with the voluntary sector. So there are key places that if the public sector gets this right, or can learn from other people that are getting it right, the ability for the whole community to benefit in every shape or form is essential. So why should the public sector care? Well, they should care because homophobia costs. It costs in terms of hate crime. Many of you will have seen the number of homophobic-related murders across the UK, and unfortunately that's a number which isn't going down. It costs in terms of bullying of children and young people. Many of you will have experienced bullying in all its forms, and no one really would want to wish it on any child or young person. And it costs in terms of social cohesion. Social cohesion, huge agenda now coming through local authorities getting rather large amounts of money to support social cohesion projects. And it's really important they recognise that social cohesion is more than talking about ethnicity. In terms of health, why does it cost? Well, it costs because if LGBT people present late with disease, it's harder to treat, it's more expensive to treat, they tend to die earlier, and those of you who work in PCTs or have been negotiating with PCTs will know that the number one priority for PCTs is reducing early mortality, so increasing life expectancy, the length that people live. And if we get people presenting late with diseases and dying early, that's going to bug your figures. If I can move on to the next slide, the one after that. Because it's not a huge amount of time, I'm not going to go into depth into all of the increasing realm of research that's appearing on lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender health. It's worth noting that at the moment, Stephen's work has been one of the few pieces of work on transgender health, and even internationally, there's very limited research which will pass the NHS gold standard of evidence, primarily because the sample sizes are quite small. And it's been, and primarily also because the research has been qualitative, so it's been talking research rather than hard numbers. And those of you who've been applying funding with PCTs will know that hard numbers are what you need to get money. Similarly, there's been very limited amount of research about bisexual health. So the majority of what we know is based on lesbian and gay populations, and we extrapolate and assume that this will be the same for transgender and for bisexual populations, some of which has been shown out in the needs assessment, some of it hasn't. So just whacking quickly through this list, mental ill health. Mental health is a huge agenda It's a huge agenda, not just for health, but also for the local authority and for the other public sector partners. People with mental health issues are more vulnerable to crime than any other group in the community. It's an issue for the police. Understanding that LGBT people have a higher risk of suicide and self-harm, and up to 1 in 6 LGBT people attempt suicide during their lives or self-harm. That's a huge number. That's a huge drain on resources. That's a lot of people going through accident emergency departments and not necessarily receiving the care or support they should need. Eating disorders are becoming an increasing problem. We've known for a while that gay men have rates of eating disorders similar to heterosexual women, and much of that's to do with body image dissatisfaction. However, some of the new research that's come out quite recently has suggested that younger lesbians are now also suffering eating disorders at the same rate as heterosexual women, and that the approaches that are being taken by the eating disorder units are not necessarily appropriate for an LGBT client base. Substance misuse, that's jargon for drugs, recreational drugs, but also prescription drugs which are used outside of the context of their prescription. Most of you will be aware of the drug Viagra, has quite a large market use outside of a prescription, although for the same purpose. If you use Viagra with some other drugs such as amyl nitrate, poppers, it can have a very serious side effect, which could ultimately lead to death. So there are issues about higher levels of substance abuse and misuse. Generally, we know that gay men use drugs longer and harder than straight men. And where straight men stop using after their late 20s, gay men carry on well into their 40s, which might be a good thing, depending how you view it. Similarly, there are issues around alcohol use. Interestingly, the research on alcohol shows that gay men drink in the same kind of pattern as straight men. Lots of binge drinking, lots of drinking at the weekends. What's interesting is that lesbians also drink in that kind of pattern, which is quite different from the way heterosexual women drink. And steroid abuse. I put this up specifically because it is an area which is of growing concern, not just because steroids, if you use them, can have quite serious side effects, including what's termed roid rage, uncontrollable anger, complications for your liver, it can impact on other medications, but also because there are risks around the needles and the injecting of steroids, and particularly around hepatitis C, which is a growing problem in the UK. Smoking, all the evidence suggests that LGBT populations smoke probably 2 to 3 times more than the general population. And the outcome of smoking, as you all know, lung cancer, chronic airways disease, coronary heart disease, stroke, death. They all cost, and they cost the big public sector a lot of money every year. Sexual health and HIV, as Paul mentioned, this is nothing new. Unfortunately, it's nothing new, and it's not really changing. One piece of work suggested, I think it's about 1 in 8 gay men on the scene in Manchester are HIV positive. It is still an issue. Prevention work is still needed. We need to start looking at new ways of engaging the youth that have grown up during an HIV epidemic. And what's also incredibly important during this phase around sexual health and HIV prevention is that as privatisation moves into the health service, that these targeted services aren't lost because they're bundled into a block contract. And those of you in community organisations should be watching like a hawk and working with your PCT non-executive directors to say, where is the gay men's HIV prevention work gone? Because in a lot of PCTs, it's gone out the window. Pregnancy and parenthood. One study showed 30% of lesbians have children, and about just under 20% of gay men have children, many of whom live with them. We need to ensure that actually across all services, and particularly as children's services move kind of across from health into the local authority in this new creature, the Children's Trust, that Children's Trust consider LGBT parenting issues and make sure their services are accessible, as well as considering the needs of LGBT youth. And one quite scary study from the US suggested that 1/3 of young people who are homeless identify as LGBT. Yet it is not a huge issue within our community, and there are very few organisations, and you're very lucky in Manchester to have organisations like the Albert Kennedy Trust and the 42nd Street Project that are engaging with these youth, but that's not the same across the country, so I would urge you to support those projects in particular. And finally, domestic violence. work by Broken Rainbow suggests 1 in 4 LGBT people experience domestic violence. That's the same rate as amongst heterosexual women. Yet, have we seen a domestic violence project targeting LGBT people? They're rare, if they're there. It's particularly important that public sector partners like the police consider how they work with LGBT communities and ensure that issues like domestic violence are considered for the LGBT population. Next slide. So what are the issues? I know Paul's covered some of these before, so I'm not going to go through them in a huge amount of detail. Visibility. We need to see the LGBT community there. We need to work with the LGBT community to ensure that the images and the representations are appropriate and are acceptable. It brings to mind Guy's and St. Thomas's Trust won an award for a diversity poster. And in the diversity poster, the gay bit was a man's fist with a leather gauntlet that was studded. Not sure that really speaks to our lesbian colleagues. Or that necessarily speaks to the whole gay population. But it was an interesting take on visibility. Knowledge and awareness. Skill up yourselves. It's not just awareness in terms of the providers, the public sector knowing what the issues are. The lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender community, the individuals need to know these are issues. The level of self-examination amongst lesbians in some of the research studies is poor, to say the least. It is shocking. And we should be working with young lesbians and older lesbians to say breast cancer can affect you in the same way that we do with generally across the population. But we don't necessarily need to do it with the same messages or the same images. There's work around disclosure, enabling a safe environment. One of the interesting pieces of work, which I think was in Swindon and Wiltshire, was they worked with general practice to put up little signs, just the kind of little things like the don't smoke signs. But it said something like, we're practice, we are accessible to all and we do not discriminate. And that was really important. Actually, those practices did see an increase in the number of people, patients disclosing to them that they were gay or lesbian. Safety and confidentiality is key. And as the NHS moves towards a common patient spine, the local authorities have a common assessment pathway, organisations and communities need to think about where they feel comfortable having that information disclosed and where it goes. Staff attitudes and response, and I know Paul mentioned training, is essential. Monitoring and evaluation. Where people are working with LGBT communities, it's really important that they monitor, they collect data, they do evaluation. Talk to some of your colleagues in the academic world. People like Stephen, who's got huge experience in academia and doing research, get advice about how to collect data so it stands up that when you go for a funding bid, the commissioner doesn't go, well, that's very interesting but not very useful. Community engagement and partnership, events like today, reaching out to the community, bridging that gap between the public sector and the voluntary sector and the community. Paul mentioned about community engagement panels. How do we ensure that the LGBT people who stand up at public events and say, I'm here, I'm queer and I've got something to say, are supported and get home safely? Next slide. So in terms of things that will help, Evelyn alluded to my role, and Christine has a similar role with the Department of Health, where we've been busily spending a tiny amount of money trying to do a huge amount of work. But there are some really useful things out there. For those of you who work in PCTs or NHS Trusts, the NHS Photo Library now has a folder called LGBT, which has 136 images of people who've consented to have their image used in a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender context. It's not perfect. We want more. But for what we managed to do, you know, with the money that we had, and people gave their time freely from the community to give their image to the NHS. And I think that was an incredibly powerful statement about how the community wants to be seen, wants to engage, wants to make things better. The Department of Health commissioned a document on core standards of training on sexual orientation. That's on the Department of Health website, as many of these others are. That does enable you to go to an organisation and say, actually, if you're training on sexual orientation, these are the standards that have been recommended that you should be looking at. They're very basic, they're very simple. Those of you who deliver training, it's probably worth looking at them just to check. It's not rocket science. We commissioned Stonewall to set up guidelines, to do a report on guidelines about staff networks and around monitoring of sexual orientation of staff. And those are now out and on both the Stonewall websites and the Department of Health website. And there's additional guidance, both from the TUC, but I would really commend Press for Change's website on how you ask the question about gender identity. Because the TUC guidance is kind of how you make a safe environment, but actually the Press for Change website has some very useful examples of questions that you might want to consider in terms of asking a question that can be sometimes a little sensitive. Moving on. And some solutions. Thinking about images, visibility is a really easy thing to say from the podium. It's very hard in an organisation to enable. Getting images costs money. And that's where things like the NHS Photo Bank are really useful, because we spent the money so you don't have to. But also working across agencies, working with organisations like LGF, to say, actually, have you got any images that would be appropriate? Can we purchase them from you? Can we work with you around the consent forms that you need in order to be able to use things on an NHS leaflet? What's been quite incredible is the way that some of these images have appeared on leaflets for physical exercise, for colon cancer, for cervical smears across the country, which is why we need to add more images, because they're getting a little old. Staff training, again, I've mentioned the core standards. Targeting community engagements. You know, the idea that Manchester Council meets with the LGBT community in a very focused way is a fantastic one, and one I've not seen anywhere else in the country. But it needs the other key partners need to be in there. The rest of the public sector need to look at that and say, either can we come in on the event and have a small group for us, or can we copy the idea? Because that's the kind of idea that can't really be copyrighted. So you might as well steal it and use it. Making sure that consultation documents, that as a community we enable the LGBT community, we support them in responding to public consultations. One of the key things is getting word out that these things are going on, but also helping people say, you know, public consultations are usually a 27-page document with about 37 questions, most of which you can't understand because they're written in department speak. It's okay to put in a response which only answers two questions. That's perfectly acceptable. But I think the 37 other questions put people off. So it is about saying there are ways to make your voice heard, which doesn't mean you have to go all the way. I'm also a great proponent of factyourmp.com. Don't know how many of you come across it. It's a wonderful way. It tells you who your local MP is. You send it like an email. They have to respond in 28 days. It's wonderful. factyourmp.com, and you can get to it through the direct.gov.uk website as well. Encouraging people to use politics. The LGBT community in the HIV epidemic in the early days were very good at direct action, but they were also very good at using democracy to make a difference. Those networks are still there. Those people still listen. One of the most powerful things you can do is look at your MP's voting records. Most recently, I think it was last week or the week before, on the Good Services and Facilities legislation. If your MP voted yes in favour of retaining the legislation as it stands, send them a factyourmp.com email saying, well done, because they need to hear it, because they'll have 20, 80, 30, 100 letters going, how dare you? And it's really important that we congratulate our MPs and our local representatives, as well as bashing them when we want them to do something different. So use democracy to make a difference. Similarly with PCTs, engaging with the patient involvement networks, working with the non-executive directors. My own PCT, we presented 5 minutes to the non-exec directors. We've now got a PCT-funded LGBT drop-in and a training program for the GPs to increase their LGBT awareness. And it's not just because I talk very quickly. Talk with the PCTs, talk with the public sector agencies about how you want to be asked the question. When I moved to Barking Duggan, where I am now, they used the term sexuality, not sexual orientation, which I struggled with for a bit. And I went and met with the community and said, you know, this is a bit odd. And they went, no, this is what we decided. We had a community consultation event. This is what we felt comfortable with. That's how it should happen. Staff networks, patient networks, network. You can never be networked enough in health. You can never be networked enough in the public sector. And the unfortunate thing is it is a full-time job for which none of us really get paid. Much of the LGBT stuff I do, all of it actually now, is around my day job. But I have a very sympathetic boss. But it is the contacts that I make that make things happen, that help things along, that mean that I can let the word out, get it out, get it there. So network, put the effort into going to meet someone face to face. Because many of these people who react initially with a no have never met an LGBT person. And they kind of still think we come from Mars and are green. And sometimes it's a bit of a shock. And actually breaking down some of those very basic barriers are really important. And I will put in a plug here. The Department of Health in April will launch a thing called the Top 10 Tips for working with LGB and the Top 10 Tips for working with transgender individuals, which are very basic introductions to working with LGBT patients. And these are designed because the National Steering Group recognised that actually the level of awareness was at the level of gay people are aliens, transgender people, God knows where they come from. This is all too much, it's all too confusing. And the reality is it isn't. So we are trying to do things to make it simple, and they will be on the Department of Health website, I'm informed, at the end of April. We've just got confirmation on that. So my final point, and this is one of our lesbian couples. Some of you who will have been involved or seen some of the press, particularly in the 80s, might recognise Linda Bellos. And her partner, Caroline James, who is the chair of Broken Rainbow. When we got the photos, and this is one of the ones from the photo bank, we went out to Southwark, which happens to be where I live, and they were holding a community event, and we said, we want to bring a photographer. Do you think people will do it? And they went, oh, we're not sure. And we got the photographer, and we put out some information the day before, and people turned up, and they turned up in large numbers, and they gave their image freely, because they wanted to make a difference. They worked with us. My suggestion is to you, work together. You can make a difference. Thank you very much.